And you'll have a couple of days to work on it. And you might wait until...
Can we turn it in early if we have like another...
You can turn it in early.
Because I have like another final...
But bear in mind that, I mean, it's due on Friday.
Midnight?
I can let you hand it in that late, but I don't think I'm going to distribute it on Wednesday. Because you're going to need what I have to say on Thursday, and there's no point in you foolishly taking off on it. So I'll make it available after class on Thursday. And you'll have 24 hours and a little more to finish it. Okay?
But then in the thing it said that like one of the worksheets is due Friday also.
Well, I'm going to have to fix that. We're obviously running out of time. Things are going to get crunchy. Let's stop doing this because I need to teach you some stuff today. And if we sit here worrying about the... Believe me, I am God in this respect. And if I decide there isn't going to be a sixth worksheet, there won't be. And maybe that's what I'm going to decide to do. Don't worry about it. It won't affect your grade. It'll come out beautifully in the end. So you all can breathe. It'll be all right. If I get enough votes that you nonetheless want to go ahead and get started on the final Wednesday night, I will make it available to you Wednesday night, if you insist. I mean, it's not no skin off my teeth, really. Just to try to, in your best interest, I would encourage you to wait until you've had Thursday's lecture to do all of it, because some of the Kant stuff we won't have had a chance to. Believe me, Kant is going to seem completely alien to you, and we only have a few days to work on it, which is why I'm going to do an intensive on Hume today, and why I'm in such a hurry today, because we're going to need all the days we have to talk about Kant. So we're going to do Hume today, we're going to do Hume for another half of tomorrow, and then I'm going to have to change direction quickly. So, are we good?
We're good.
All right. Okay. So here's the thing. Hume has the same kind of input-output model of mind that you all are familiar with from Locke. So, but in his case, the inputs are called impressions. Okay, these are the inputs. And unlike Locke also, he has three kinds. Impressions of sensation, those are the familiar ones. The impressions from our sensory faculties. Impressions of reflection, right? And impressions of emotion. Some of you wondered what Locke was going to do with emotion. Remember, back a ways, you know, what about those? Because those seem to be part of mental content that comes up in our awareness. And so he has an account of emotion. He thinks emotions are distinguishable impressions that have a different origin than the impressions of reflection or the impressions of sensation. Okay? So he's added a third kind of input, because he thinks that it's not really accurate to combine emotion, right, which seems to be a non-sensory input. You know, emotions, remember we talked about fear? Fear has a physical component, what we think of as a physical component. We have sensations that go with fear, but we also have emotions that go with fear, and those seem to be distinct. And emotions in that sense seem to be very different from those impressions of the operations of our mind. We don't think of emotions as consequences of acts of will or acts of memory or acts of judgment or acts of comparison or acts of reasoning, right? They seem to be a very different, they have different origins. There isn't an emotional organ of mind that we associate with any of the faculties I just mentioned. So he wants to name things according to their causes. And so in this case, impressions of emotion are a distinguishable kind of input. He thinks that the mind is empty until sensations first arise. But after that, I think in principle, he has to accept that maybe there might also be, you might start mental content with emotions. But most of us, I think, are inclined to notice. I think if we just notice how emotions work for us, typically something else has to be going on in our awareness, and then we have our emotional reactions to it, right? Now, there is some countervailing evidence there. Some people who are afflicted with certain kinds of persisting emotions, right, that don't seem to have their origins in what's happening, but rather in some condition of their emotional nature, might, you know, say, oh, maybe when minds start out, you can, you know, be afflicted with anxiety. And I can't really comment on whether that's possible or not. I think in principle, it's possible. And what would matter is whether, in fact, there are any human minds that start off with their first mental content being, you know, joy or, you know, anxiety or, you know, fear or whatever. So, but in any case, there aren't any of these kinds of impressions until they're at least these, and maybe also these, okay? So those are the inputs, according to Hume. The processors include a new faculty in addition to all the faculties that you heard about from Locke, which were memory, reasoning, or what he called reflection, which includes comparison, right, and deduction, right, logical inferences. Those kinds of acts of mind are involved in reflection. Those are things we do with our reasoning power. And the passive faculties of perception and the active faculty of imagination, right? The active kind and the passive power of perception, which really is just these faculties. Since this is mental processors, we have to include among the mental processors the inputs. But really, they don't additionally, they just give us the inputs, but they're a part of the mind, so you can include them here. But they're not, you know, it isn't like you're going to hand off an input from vision to your, over to, you know, another faculty of of perception, right? Unless you're on acid. Then I don't think you hand it off. I just think everything gets scrambled and the inputs get all mixed up. So, but then there's one new faculty, which I mentioned yesterday, and it is the imagination conceived as a passive faculty. He says it's a mysterious faculty power of the soul. It operates in the background, and the only evidence of its operation lies in those parts of our ideas, which are copies of impressions, which we can't account for by pointing to what was in the original inputs. Okay. So Hume actually takes the view that all the relations that exist among the copies of impressions you have stored in memory, all their relations ultimately depend on the activity of the passive imagination, which is acting on incoming impressions and adding content to them of the following kind. It doesn't actually, so we've got to think in the assembly line way. Here's my consciousness. It's just like, and what it's being fed by impressions. And let's just imagine that it's just one of those newsreels where somebody's working in a factory and there's, you know, there are things coming along and they're you know, like, and they're like, they're selecting out good almonds, right, and putting them in boxes. So that's kind of what's happening when you're perceiving. Your mind is like a factory which is waiting for inputs. As the almonds come down, your mind picks them up, you might say, looks at them, and then puts them in a memory box. And in the process of putting them in the memory box, things are actually being sorted. And you're not aware of this sorting process. The sorting is being done by the passive imagination. Okay? So, as impressions come along, here's consciousness, and there's the memory box, and things are dropping in, right? Before they drop in, there is a, you can imagine like a little person who's looking at it, grabbing it, having a look at it, inspecting it, and then deciding where in all of the little boxes in memory for each of the different resembling things, right? Things that are related in various ways, things you will later associate with this incoming impression. It decides where to drop them. So this impression resembles something, all things that you've seen that are white, and that gets dropped here in the box where all the white things go, right? And similarly with things that taste like almond, and similar things that, right, that feel smooth and so on. So you see how the imagination works? The imagination works, the passive imagination works, it's like a filter. Except that this filter actually produces something. We think of filters normally as sorting out all everything according to types, right? And separating them. And there's a sense in which the imagination does that. But it's not only sorting, it's also connecting things that are being filtered with other things that were filtered before that thought, according to a set of principles. The principles are, one, resemblance. So if an incoming impression resembles something that you've seen, touched, tasted, smelled, or felt before, it will be, the passive imagination will create an associative link from that impression, the copy of that impression, to other idea, other copies, other ideas that resemble it. Okay? The second criterion that the passive imagination uses is whether incoming impressions are close together in time. If two impressions come in close together in time, imagination automatically associates them as it stores them in memory. Also, if they're close together in space, we are more likely to associate things we've seen that were close together in space. I associate more strongly my impressions of the regions of my visual field, right, that are near each other. Those remain close together in memory. Even if they come from different senses, this is how I'm able to associate the corner of the desk as I touch it with the corner of the desk as I see it, and those are strongly associated in my mind. So they're so strongly associated that most of you originally had a little trouble understanding how Locke thought we were able to have the idea of the corner of the desk in more than one sense. Right? But we really do. But we naturally tend to think of it as if it's one idea, right? Because we combine what we see and what we feel in a given region of space and take and so strongly associate the touch of the corner and the sight of the corner, the way the corner looks, that we just take them to be somehow the same thing. That's a very strong association. That association, given that the inputs can come in separate, and most impressions stored in memory, most of our ideas did come in separately. The ones that are strongly associated with a given region of space are associated because of this principle. And the passive imagination simply applies these rules as, in creating associations between incoming impressions as they're being copied and stored in memory, and other memories, other ideas that have been stored before. And the last thing that the passive imagination is looking for are things that are constantly conjoined. What do you call constant conjunctions? So, for example, now this only kicks in when you had a bunch of you have to have had a bunch of perceptions, and you have to have been perceiving for a while and copying impressions and storing them in memory. And once you've started to do that, and I was just, while you guys were taking the exam yesterday, I was listening to a very interesting podcast, which consists of an interview with some developmental psychologists talking about the infant brain. And one of the things that is coming out about the way that infant brains develop between birth and, about the end of the second year of life, is that babies seem to be constituted such that they are just looking for things that happen that are correlated, and they strongly respond to things that are, you know, combinations of events that are repeated. So it turns out we now have some brain imaging evidence and some Piagetian techniques for studying the development of children's minds, which strongly suggest that Hume was right. That the human mind does strongly associate events, tastes, colors, all the sorts of things that our sensory faculties are able to detect. We strongly associate things that happen close together in space and time and happen over and over again. Right? So in fact, those behaviors who said that maybe a lot of learning is just stimulus response and just repetition. We gradually associate things that are repeated, like Pavlov's dog, right? You remember the experiment with Pavlov's dog? Are you all familiar with it? Pavlov's dog, Pavlov was a Russian, I guess you would call him a Russian psychologist / biologist, and he was studying how dogs learn things. And one of his experiments involved keeping a dog in a box where every time a bell rang, there was a bell in the box. These eventually came to be called Skinner boxes, if you're familiar with B.F. Skinner. But the dog was confined in this box, and there was a bell that would go off, and then the door with the food where the food would arrive would open, and food would appear. And if you did this enough times, the dog would eventually start to salivate as soon as the bell rang and before the food got there. And this Pavlov took as evidence that there is a kind of, you know, we learn by associating things that happen repeatedly, close together. One thing follows another, right? And a lot of people have theories of child rearing that are based on this principle, right? If you want your children to be well-behaved, then what you have to do is create positive association with good behavior, right? So you reward them when they do the things you want them to do, and you punish them when they do the things you don't want them to do. And between positive and negative reinforcement, people come to, you know, you get the kid you want. Any parents in here? Well, I know one, but she's working with a very young human at this point, so, who's still working on those correlations and making those connections. Not talking yet.
I have a little sister.
Thank God. It's so wonderful before they speak, you know, before they can have an opinion different than yours, right? Sorry?
Oh, I have a little sister that's 5.
Okay.
So watching that.
Yeah. So you. And this is a part of child rearing, but everybody who's raised children knows that there's something resistant to this kind of training. So there are some things that seem to be in the constitution of the kid. You have a kid who's fastidious, you have a kid who's carefree, and you don't know why. And it has nothing to do with whether you were fastidious, or it's mysterious sort of how they get that way. Sometimes it's the grandparent that was like that, you know. But anyway, there are all kinds of interesting things that are going on here. I only mention all of this interesting stuff because I want you to realize that Hume's idea of how it is that we come to associate, you know, ideas with each other, there's strong empirical evidence to suggest that his fundamental picture is quite accurate. And it's amazing that he was able to develop this theory, given that at the time there was no science of psychology. In fact, this is the closest thing to a science of psychology that we have, the work of Locke, the work of Hume. And then gradually in the 19th century, official psychology separates itself off as a discipline, and it uses many of the insights that were drawn from the empiricist philosophers. So it's worth noting it. And in fact, I noticed that lots of the same issues are still, lots of the same arguments between the nativists, and they call them nativists now, and empiricists who think that everything is learned more or less this way. So babies don't come with any kind of hard wiring. They have no ideas. Everything they come to know, including principles of grammar and so on, they all learn this other way. So there's a big fight going on among people working on childhood development and development of brain of the human mind, between, you know, people who think there's a nativist contribution, there's something native to the mind, something built in, hardwired in the brain, and those who think, well, the only thing that's hardwired is so basic that, you know, like, there is a hardwired thing about sounds. Turns out that all babies, your baby, can distinguish 600 different phonemes, but you can't, because you were exposed to only one language, probably, or maybe two, or three, but a minimum, you know, and not all human natural languages use all the phonemes. And so what babies do is that as they, in the early stages, sometime around between the first and the second year, they gradually, they are having reinforced the phonemes of the native speakers in the language that they're being exposed to. And they start to pick those up and distinguish them more, you know, you might say brightly in their mind. And the other ones, the ones that aren't in use, by the time they're 2 years old, their responsiveness to these, their ability to even detect them starts to fade. So there's apparently our ability to detect these 600 phonemes that human beings can produce with their vocal cords is hardwired, right? So that part seems to be a nativist account. But the role it plays in your, those phonemes play in your language is largely a function of reinforcement, exposure to certain sounds, and lack of reinforcement, negative reinforcement. Well, it's not negative, it's just, it sort of fades. The associations fade, right? You forget what your grandmother's face looked like as the years go by, and you don't get to see her again and have it renewed, right? And this is one of the things that I also love about Hume's theory. It actually coincides accurately with our phenomenological, our own experiences with the way that memory works and the way that the way that associations work. You know, when you're practicing something, when you're thinking about Hume's philosophy, it's all much more vivid. As time goes by and you don't reinforce that, it gradually fades because, you know, unless you use it, right? We say you lose it. Ideas have a tendency to fade. And in fact, Hume thinks that the primary difference, I promise to tell you, the primary difference between ideas and impressions, the primary difference for Hume between ideas and impressions is that ideas as copies are less forceful and vivacious. They're less lively. They don't have the liveliness, the vividness, is what I mean by lively. And the less often, you know, you make that kind, that one dish, you know, the harder it is for you to remember what it tastes like. You need repetition in order to keep the ideas lively. Now, one way you can make an idea lively, and you can even make an idea lively enough to rival impressions, incoming impressions for liveliness and forcefulness, impressiveness, is by constant repetition of the idea. So, if you're wondering how somebody could have Ayn Rand's libertarian philosophy so vividly in mind, well, one way to do that is to go to the libertarian, you know, meetings and the Randian, you know, Admiration Society meetings, and then read her books over and over again, and talk to other people who believe in that ideology, that way of looking at things. A particular kind of theory of life and the way of succeeding in life. It's a certain theory of social life. And eventually those ideas become so vivid, right, that they are as they're as vivid as any ideas you have. So you can actually, and maybe that arguably is how people can come to have such strong convictions about what, after all, often is a so far not yet fully, you know, substantiated set of theories about, you know, it's just like somebody can strongly believe that evolution is an incomplete science and there must be some role for intelligent action in the unfolding of the speciation of nature's creatures, right? And if you spend more time looking at challenges to evolutionary theory than you spend looking at, you know, the evidence, the arguments and evidence in favor of evolutionary theory, you're gradually going to find yourself very strongly inclined toward the, you know, toward the idea that evolution is flawed, even if a balanced view of all the evidence maybe doesn't make it so, you know, so dubious. But if you just emphasize it enough, you will naturally come to judge the question tilted in favor of those principles which you have repeatedly investigated and you've checked. You know, it's just like staring at Descartes' proofs and ignoring all the criticisms, right? And of course, we think that a fair way of judging any argument or principle, scientific or otherwise, requires us to look at the kind of arguments and evidence for it, care fairly, and look at all of the evidence, not just selected parts. And all of you, I'm sure, know people who seem to be not looking at all of the evidence, right? And it can be a little frustrating when someone is doing that. Sometimes it's admirable. Sometimes holding on to a principle, however, you know, however much it's sort of a psychological fact that you believe it, sometimes ends up being useful. You know, these studies that show that people who believe that they're, most of us think we're smarter than we are. And those of us who think we're significantly smarter than we actually are do better on tests than those who tend to estimate their intelligence more realistically, the people who look into this. So there's a way in which some of our, you know, being delusional is sometimes a good thing. You just don't want to get too delusional. Okay? So this is this new faculty, which is the main purpose of this part of the lecture, just you be aware that Hume invents what is now the modern view of imagination, which incorporates both the active imagination, which we had since Plato and before probably, the idea that we can construct ideas from ideas we already have, particularly ones that are like our sensory ideas. So we can create unicorns and, you know, werewolves, and even though we've never witnessed them. That's the active imagination. The passive imagination involves the power to connect up ideas that arrive in the mind separately. And it, in Hume's hands, it accounts for our ability to compare ideas and to find ideas that are similar and to find them easily. It provides us with a structure for memory and a structure for accessing what's stored in memory according to the resemblances of ideas. Ideas that are very unlike each other are stored without these associative links. Ideas that really are nearly identical in their content are strongly associated, so that when you think of the one, you have a very strong tendency to think of the other. Same thing for those that came in close together in time, even more so if they came also together close in space, which is often the case when you're perceiving. You know, things that are close in space are your vision takes in a lot, right? And things that are close by get taken in together. So that's even more. So things that you see at the same time and in the same, you know, place, you very strongly associate. And if you see them over and over again, you associate them even more strongly.
What's number four say? I can't really read it.
That is constant conjunction.
So that means over and over again together.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Repeated, here you need more than one impression. Two impressions that are being experienced close together, and I mean, to correlate them, constant conjunction just presupposes close together in time. Usually that also involves close together in space. Mm-hmm. So all that's being added here is repetition
of things that have been reinforced due to these relationships as they came in. Okay? Any questions so far, Casey?
How many perceptions are slipping through the mind, or how many almonds are going past the...
Wow. I think that it's very hard to say, because I think if you approach this the way that Hume did, which was to start with the phenomenological, what is it like? You know, what is it like to be aware of impressions? Like you asked me, so I'm going to now try to attend to all the impressions I'm currently getting. And it's a really large number, as I, right? But there's another thing that's operating here which makes it hard to answer that question with a specific number. How much of the many impressions I'm getting at once from all five senses, right? I'm getting them all the time, but I'm not attending to all of them all the time, right? Depending on my acuity of awareness, my ability to focus, how awake I am, in other words, and to what extent I'm distracted, you know. I recently let a friend down by... we were going to go to a yoga class together. She was going to come and pick me up at my place. And I was already in my tights and, you know, try this thing. And because I'm not very limber, so yoga is hard for me. And I got a Skype call from a friend of mine in London. And I had the headphones on in my room in the back where I can't hear a damn thing happening anywhere. I can't hear the front door. I can't hear the back door. She didn't have her phone, so she couldn't call me. She's banging on doors, and I'm not hearing it. And we're having a discussion now about whether being distracted in the way I was is my fault or not. She's mad. That's okay. I totally get that she's upset. I'd be upset too, you know. But how we're going to avoid this in the future. Now we're talking about whether you can arrange to not be distracted.
Well, have you ever seen that study?
And that just turns out to be really difficult, because it's in the nature of distraction that you don't plan on it. You're focusing on one thing, and then something distracts you. Oh my God, Elvis! You know, this is the way human beings are, sadly. You know. Yes?
You might be getting to this, and if so, you can shut me down.
No shutdown.
Who is the almond digger?
Who's the almond picker?
Yeah,
your
that?
Consciousness is the... Well, no. The almond picker is the passive imagination, which is a secret faculty of your soul, of your mind, according to Hume, which is carefully inspecting everything that comes in, comparing it to things already stored in memory. It's a
is
pretty powerful...
Knowledge?
I mean, it's a little godlike thing when you think about it. If there's a problem for Locke's theory, it might be that this faculty has to do so much and do it so well that you begin to wonder how any part of your mind, especially if it's unconscious, could be that smart. Because it seems to be really on top of its shit. It's got really, it seems to be keeping track of everything that you've ever seen and then noticing that, oh, this is another one of those, so let's store it over here with the things that are like it.
Yeah,
so it's a pretty it's a pretty powerful faculty, but the picker is the passive imagination. John, did you?
I was going to say something, but it's kind of unrelated, and I thought maybe...
Good, then let's not do it.
Yeah.
You and I can talk about it later. Because this gets hairy, and I haven't even gotten to what we really need to go over today. So, we have ideas that are the product of this copying, which is a natural power associated with memory. Memory, by the way, you have to think of memory as a bimodal power. It's a power of storage, but it's also a power of retrieval. And we speak as if, you know, anyone who has memory has both, right? You can store things, though, and not be able to retrieve them, right? And usually when we talk about I'm having trouble with my memory, we mean not that it's not stored, but that we can't get to it. But we need both. And Hume understands memory to be a combination of this passive faculty that just records everything to some degree of fine grainedness, right? And exactly how much, Casey, of that massive influx of data that we're getting all the time, I don't know. I think it depends on the acuity of the mind involved and how much data it can handle. I think there are well-established limits for human beings about how much
You know, like how long a string of numbers can you hold on to before you are no longer able to? You know, most people, I think 7 is the average. If you're learning random numbers, you know. A friend of mine got himself up to 18, you know, with some tricks. But there are limits here. So, and the output of all of this, of course, are just ideas and beliefs. I want to say something about this because this is basically broadly all mental content. So this is just like Locke. We're accounting for all the contents of the mind. And all of the contents of the mind ultimately are accountable to either original inputs, the actual literal content of impressions, copied, literally copied, or it's a consequence of associative links among them. And everything that we believe, belief is just a species, is just, you might say, an attitude that we can't help taking. It's the way consciousness relates to the content of consciousness. I mean, Hume wants to account for what is going on when I believe something. And he realizes that I believe a lot of things that I never decided to believe. And this was one of the problems with Descartes' theory of judgment, wasn't it? Remember? He tells us that we didn't talk about this problem, but it is a problem for Descartes. Descartes thinks that you can, remember in the fourth meditation, we will make no errors in judgment if only we restrain our will to those beliefs, those possible beliefs, which are within the scope of the intellect. So if I can fully grasp the proposition, and it contains all and only clear and distinct ideas and seems self-evidently true, then I can trust it and I can apply my will to that proposition and make it into a belief, right? That's his story. And he says you can avoid all error by simply withholding assent, restraining your will. The problem with that view, in part, one obvious problem is I believe all sorts of things that I never actually willed, I never chose to believe them. I just find myself believing them, right? You believe what you see in a certain sense, right? And that's what Hume exploits. He thinks belief is just an attitude that your mind takes toward what it's aware of. It's just a special kind of attitude. It's an attitude associated with complexes of ideas which are organized in the form of a proposition or an assertion. And all that you're adding to the assertion is what you have, is that relationship, that, you might say, that attitude that you have when you open your eyes. And you don't think of that as an act of belief, but Hume thinks it's the same thing. You know, you kind of rise to your consciousness, right? You rise to whatever you perceive, right? You turn your attention to it willingly, and you give yourself over to it. That's what it is to believe for Hume. So this is another beauty of Hume's theory, that his account of perception and of the origins of ideas accounts for another property of human mental life, which hadn't been accounted for except as a mystery, as a product of another faculty, the faculty of judgment. But when you look into, well, how do judgments get made, right? If you look at the phenomenology of belief, he thinks you'll realize that all that's happening is you are turning your mind to a proposal. To a possible assertion. The way that you turn your mind to things that are coming in, and the way you accept what you see, you know, the way you sign on to it, don't you? You believe it. That's what it is. So he actually is taking seeing as believing to a new level. Perception is the origin of believing. It's the same relationship applied to a mind that is attending not an incoming impression, but rather a set of ideas organized in the form of an assertion. And that's all it is to believe. And so there's a nice unity to this theory, which explains higher functions in terms of lower functions. Whereas with Locke, we just got higher functions and they got tacked on, you know, to the same mind that had the lower functions, and the products of the lower functions just were handed off to the power of judgment. And that works in a kind of a loose-grained way, but if you want to know exactly how that's possible, for example, it would be good if the act of belief is actually a species of an act of perception, and that's what Hume has given us. So it has a nice internal coherence that I think has real beauty. Okay, so one of the things that comes out of this theory is Hume's version of the acquisition process. So this is the same principle, but it is stated somewhat differently because of differences in the two theories. The acquisition thesis said all ideas are complex or are simple, are simple or complex, and the complex are built up by processing, mechanical processing, comparison, abstraction, so on, the original contents of simple ideas. And all are traceable back to original simple ideas of sensation, reflection, or both, right? Well, the correspondence principle is Hume's corollary. He says all ideas correspond to their original impressions. Full stop. Gives you the same principle that you can apply for doing philosophical analysis. So any mental content you have must be traceable back to original impressions of sensation, emotion, reflection, or some combination of the three. Okay? So, since all ideas are just copies, this Xerox copy theory of the world says that all mental life is just built up out of Xerox copies. Right? Now, there's one other thing that happens, and these copies are associated with each other according to these four principles. And so, all ideas, the more complex ideas are a consequence of abstraction or combination based on associative links among simple ideas, right? So after you get the original copies of the original impressions, everything after that that's more complex, all complex ideas like the idea of the desk, or general ideas like the idea of desks, idea of chairs and so on, are constructed the same way that Locke said, by comparison of ideas, which we now have, when we're now, the mind is now, because of the associative principle, because we associate ideas that are resembling, experienced close together in space and time, or constantly conjoined in experience together in these ways, we naturally tend to think of them as having some kind of strong connection to each other. We think of them as being related some important way. And that leads us to generate concepts on the basis of these relationships. And we actually come to believe that those events, right, which are, you know, events of, you know, of one type, let's say, events like the cue ball being struck by a cue stick and moving toward and striking the eight ball, which then falls in the side pocket. There we have two events. Event A, which is the cue stick striking the cue ball and then moving in the direction of and hitting the eight ball. And then the other event is the eight ball moving off into the side pocket. Okay? So, cue ball, etc., eight ball, etc. These are two events. And if you see that enough times, according to Hume, you will come to strongly associate events of this kind with events of this kind. This is where you get the idea of a causal relationship, according to Hume. Any questions about that? Because we're going to, I'm going to introduce another couple of ideas, and then I'm going to show you how, we're going to go through this handout, and I'm going to show you how he argues for the claim that the concept of a causal relationship, which Descartes had, which Locke had, and which all other philosophers have had up until Hume, is mistaken. There's a fundamental problem with it. And because of this problem, we have to come up with an alternative theory of what a causal relationship is, because it isn't what we thought it is. So it's important that you understand how we come, at least on the straightforward, on his general theory of how ideas are stored in memory and associated one with another, how we come, being good little, little Pavlovian doggies. Human minds are just like Pavlovian doggy minds in this respect. We strongly associate things that are reinforced in the way that I just described. So he says that your idea of a causal relationship in general, and the most general principle of causal relations that we have, is the principle of sufficient reason, right? The idea that everything that exists has a cause. That's just a generalization from the idea that this event has a cause, and that event, and that event, and that event, right? That's how empiricists think we come to develop general laws of nature. And this is the most basic one, right? That everything has a cause. Because you can't do a science of nature if you don't have access to the idea of a causal relation, correct? Because what is science telling us? It's telling us how things really are, but how does it do that? It tells us what causes the things as they are and what doesn't, right? When I'm talking about the evidence that children have a built-in tendency to look for correlations, they're little pattern detection devices. They come that way. When I say that, I'm informing you of some causal relationships that some cognitive psychologists and developmental psychologists have managed to show, give us the principles for, and those principles are based on observations of various causal relationships, right? And it just turns out that it appears that the cause of a baby associating a certain word with a certain person does appear to be the fact that, they had experiences where the two were conjoined, and they have this tendency to believe in a correlation more strongly because of the way their minds are built. So there are two causes here, and this principle is the explanatory principle which a cognitive psychologist studying the development of human minds at this age is trying to reveal. So it is, if we find out that the very idea of a causal relationship is flawed and can't apply to the world of our perceptions as we think it does, that would be a problem, wouldn't it? Remember the trouble that we had when Locke applied his theory to his own acquisition thesis to the idea of a substance, and what that did to the theory of identity. It had to be changed, right? Well, similarly, the whole philosophy of science, the part of the philosophy of science that depends on the principle of sufficient reason, would have to be rethought. If Hume's application of his theory of ideas to the idea of a causal relationship has the consequences that he thinks it does. So, anybody have any questions about how we come to take it that some events are causes and others are their effects? The idea of this relationship being causal is simply a strong association we have between these two events. Because they happen close together in space and time, there's something resembling between the motion of the cue ball and the motion of the eight ball, strongly resembling, right? Even including the vectors, right? I mean, when the ball, the moving cue ball hits the stationary eight ball, it's moving in a general direction, and the eight ball always goes off in that same general direction, right? That's one of the rules, apparently, of motion. And so they're resembling, and if you see it enough times, you will come to believe that this event was caused by this, and this is just a byproduct of our natural, what we come to naturally believe, given the way we strongly associate events that have these properties.
Okay.
Yeah.
So causality for Hume could basically be explained as an overly strong association?
Well, yes, it's a very strong association. That's exactly what it is. And notice this is a deeply psychological account of what causal relationships are. If there are any realists out there who think that causal relations are things in the world between cue balls and eight balls, and that would exist whether or not any mind is witnessing these events, right? You might be disturbed by the fact that this account of the idea of a causal relationship seems to be so psychological in its orientation. But this is the empiricist enterprise in this period. They accept that their access to the world is through perception, and the world they're going to know is a world of perception. They don't have any other way of getting to the world than through perception. And unlike Locke, Hume is going to, and I'll show you this tomorrow, but Hume is going to actually take that so seriously that he's going to discover that there's a metaphysical concept that we need in order to infer from our perceptions the existence of mind-independent entities existing, whether or not our minds exist, namely the causes of those perceptions. And that inference is based on applying the idea of a causal relationship, that everything that exists, like a perception, has a cause, something outside my mind. He's going to show that that very principle can't be applied in general, or in these specific cases, to our perceptions. We can't treat our perceptions as effects because we have no right to claim that there is a causal relationship between our perceptions, let alone between our perceptions as effects in our minds and non-mental, non-perceptual causes in bodies or entities existing independent of the mind. So it's going to turn out that this is going to have some pretty devastating skeptical consequences, which will eventually lead us to conclude that Hume to conclude that there's a problem with the claim that we know there is an external world. But I don't want to go there yet. Okay. So let me now introduce you to one other idea you're going to need in order to make use of this handout, and then we're going to get started on the handout. Hume, I've told you that Hume thinks that belief is a species of perception. It's like perception. It's an attitude you take toward what you are aware of. Except that in the case of belief, what you're aware of is a proposition or a judgment, an assertion, rather than a perception. Okay. Now, and there is a handout for this, so if you flip over to the third page, where I give you his theory of truth and judgment, it's laid out there that Hume thought there are two kinds of beliefs that are organized according to how they can be justified. Okay. One kind of belief is what he calls a relations of ideas belief. Beliefs of this kind are justified because of relations that exist between the ideas when you consider the proposition. So, for example, one of the classic beliefs of this kind, which is justified just by appeal to relations that the mind takes to exist among ideas that are before it, is the belief that bachelors are unmarried males. Yeah.
Is this just like definitions?
These are very much like definitions are one class of this kind of belief.
Yeah.
And some of them are completely arbitrary, right? Like the rule that rooks move or bishops move diagonally in chess. You know, that's a definitional property of, right, of the function of the bishop in chess. And similarly, bachelors are unmarried males is true because the concept of the word bachelor just refers to this concept, and that concept is just the concept of an unmarried male, right? It could have been some other concept, but we've decided arbitrarily. But it seems universally in all cultures that have marriage, they seem to have this idea of the unmarried person, unmarried male person. They're the bachelors, right? So when I think that proposition, what makes it true?
Convention decided that that's how we're.
And what does that mean? What do you mean by convention?
We as humans came up with the term bachelor to describe exactly what you are describing when you use the term.
Right. So if someone asks me how it is that I know that bachelors are unmarried males is true, I might start the way you did by saying, well, it's true by definition. It's true by, you know, by convention. Yeah. We have attached that word to, you know, that word to those other words. And now I will, because I'm philosophically inclined and this is a philosophy class, I have to push you to give an even better explanation. Surely you aren't telling me that this is just about words. The word bachelor refers to something, doesn't it? And you know, it's not just a word. It refers to some meaning, right? And the words unmarried male together, those refer to something too, right? And so there are actual entities out there. And you could take these words to refer to the entities. And if you took it that way, you could say bachelors are unmarried males is true. The way that the ball is red is true because the words involved point to the same entity. And how do I know this? Because I went and looked. And every time I found a bachelor, I also noticed that this was an unmarried male. That could be the way that the justification worked, right? But doesn't that sound weird and screwy? That's not what you were trying. You were trying to tell me something else when you told me about the role of convention and definition, right? Conventions and definitions are connecting those entities out there. Nobody out there gets to be a bachelor who gets to also be, you know, anything other than an unmarried male. So I don't have to go look in the world at all. Yeah. That's not what makes it true. It's the concept of bachelor. This is like triangles have three sides. The number two is even. There's something in the concept of the subject, right, bachelor, which is simply revealed. You might say the predicate concepts simply reveal what's contained in the concept of bachelor. So if somebody understands what the word bachelor points to, which is the concept of bachelor, and if they grasp the concept of bachelor correctly, then they will realize that this statement amounts to, logically, this statement. It's just a tautology. And all definitions are tautologies. They tell you in what something's self-identity consists, right? So the reason Hume calls these relations of ideas judgments is that all you need in order to see why they're true is to see the relations that already exist among the ideas. If you grasp the proposition correctly, you will see that the concept of bachelor is just related to the concept of unmarried male in the way that's asserted, in the identity way. They are identical. And thus, we know it's true because we can see the relations among the ideas. So that's what secures the truth. And what secures the relations among the ideas? That's the rest of the story, and that's what you guys are telling me. Convention. Usually. Right? I mean, it didn't. The concept of bachelor, I mean, you could be a Platonist and say the concept of bachelor is written into the heavens. It's, you know, there are, you know, it's just there. You've got to deal with it, you know. That doesn't seem very compelling, at least when it comes to bachelor. What about on those planets where there aren't any, there isn't marriage? And there are some interesting go-arounds among philosophers about what to do with those cases. And similarly, Hume thinks that all mathematical judgments amount to judgments that are simply noticing and asserting a relationship among ideas, which we come to grasp by simply attending to the ideas. So if we understand addition, and we understand the concept of two, we understand that if you add two to two, you get four. So all you need is to have the concepts in order to see what makes that true. What makes it true is that four is identical to two twos added together. And you don't have to go, you don't have to take objects and, right? Wouldn't that be weird? What if, when you were in second grade, your teacher said, prove that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Do you think it would be any good if you did this? Teach, just a second. Okay, watch. Come here. Look. Okay, here are two pieces of chalk, and here are two pieces of chalk. Now I'm going to bring them together. See? That's my proof. Well, lucky for you, the world goes along with facts about numbers so that objects that are numerable seem to reflect that. But it's a highly controversial claim that what makes 2 plus 2 equals 4 has to do with objects. Because most of us think that the concept of a number doesn't have anything to do with the concept of an object and seems to be true independent of its application in the world. So the best you can say is it's very nice that the numerability of the world is there, and it lines up with our system of arithmetic. But the natural number system is something that really stands independent of objects like these. And most people, even those who think that we come to the rules of arithmetic by observing objects, don't think that the rules of arithmetic are true because of what's true about objects. Right? So, but in any case, Hume and Locke think that a judgment of this kind is a judgment about how ideas are related to each other. And if you grasp the ideas, that's all you need to see that they're true. Okay. And you might say that this other stuff might have to do at best with how you come to have the idea. And I think, in fact, Hume and Locke will agree that you get the idea of number by noticing the countability of objects. But once you have the concept of number, it's not any longer attached to any object. And that's the beauty of it. It can be applied across a whole range, right, of things, even to non-objects. Anything that's numerable, you can use numbers to describe their numerability, right? And there are all kinds of numerable things, some of which are physical objects, some of which are dreams, some of which are fantasies, some of which are totally abstract entities, and so on. Okay? Here's one round square, here's another. Okay? All right. So that's one kind of judgment. There's another kind of judgment, which is the much more common kind. And we've already actually considered it when we were considering the wrong way of justifying the claim that bachelors are unmarried males by going out and looking for bachelors and unmarried males and seeing if they're the same. Well, there is a whole class of propositions where that's exactly what you have to do. You have to go out into the world of perception looking for what corresponds to the subject concept. And you've got to see that what corresponds to the predicate concepts can be found in a single perception in which all are combined. So when I say the ball is red, that's true if and only if I can find something that I perceive which falls under the concept of ball and also has the property of being red. If I can see a bulb that's also red, then I know that at least in that case, the proposition the ball is red, where I'm referring to that ball, is true. So what makes it true are conditions out here in the world, which we access through perception. So, and everything about the conditions of the world are what he means, you know, which we only know about through perception, involve what he calls matters of fact. So matter of fact judgments have the, so we looked at the relations of ideas judgments. All judgments have the form S is P. S is P is equivalent to this.
That thing just beeped.
Concept is identical. What?
That just beeped.
Oh, it did? Yeah, it's running out of time. That's just the way it is. Get the rest from the handouts.